I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation with a young American bringing Iraqis to the U.S. to keep them out of harm's way. He's placed one Iraqi couple in his parents' spare bedroom. But first, a school committee vote in Portland, Maine is sparking a national debate over birth control for young students. In a 7-2 vote last night, the committee approved prescribing contraception, such as the pill, to kids aged 11 to 15 at the King Middle School Health Center. The clinic's physician, Dr. Pat Patterson, spoke in favor of the proposal last night.
It's been shown over and over again that this does not increase sexual behaviors. In some studies, it has been shown to actually slightly diminish sexual activity.
Three parents also spoke in favor of the proposal, but nine against it last night, including Diane Miller, who worried the vote would increase sexually transmitted disease.
How safe are we keeping them from herpes, from chlamydia, from gonorrhea, from trichomonas, HPV virus, which is now proven leads to cancer in the future? The ramifications of what you are considering is mind-boggling to me.
Jeff Wade is news director for WGAN Radio in Portland. Jeff, help us put this in context, because we understand, first of all, this health center is actually a community health center that's housed at the school.
Yes, it's operating separately from the school, although it deals only with students at the King Middle School.
There are over 1,000 of these kind of community health centers set up across the country in this way, and we understand that a student must have written permission from a parent to go to the center.
Yes, the key here is that not everybody at the middle school uses the health center. You have to sign up separately. There's a consent form that must be signed by parents. However, after the parents sign the consent form, Maine law does not require the parents to be informed when the students seek out contraceptives.
Well, we actually understand that by state law, the kids must have confidential treatment, not just of reproductive care, but mental health care and substance abuse.
Yes, and so in that way, it's become a concern because a parent would not know if a student was sexually active or was seeking out contraceptives from this health center. Mm-hmm. But the parents do first have to consent to have the students use the health center. About 130 students at the King Middle School make use of the health center each academic year.
Well, it would seem then that since parents can prevent their children from even going, they have that option. But I'm wondering, is one of the questions, you know, parents who can afford private doctors can maybe afford to keep their kids out of the clinic, but can lower-income parents, have that same choice?
Well, that's part of the reason the health center is at the King Middle School. It's the only middle school in Portland that has a health center of its own, and that, according to officials, is because of the fact that they have the majority of the students in Portland at the middle school level that are getting low or a reduced fare or free lunch. And I guess the concern there is that if they're not eating particularly well, then they have need of other health services. So there possibly is a correlation there, although I think officials have been somewhat reluctant to draw that.
So there's a presumption that the center services a lot of low-income kids, again, as you said, judging by how many need a lunch service.
Yeah, and the majority of the services are not related to this at all. Last academic year, only of the 134 students who made use of the health center, only 4 or 5 reported being sexually active. However, of greater concern is that at the middle school level, there's been a report over the last several years, over a span of the last 4 or 5 years, that 17 middle school students have reported pregnancy. That's kind of what prompted people to take this action last night.
Those were 17 pregnancies at Portland's 3 middle schools, we understand.
Yes, that's all the middle schools. That's not mm-hmm. just the King Middle School.
Well, Jeff, what are you hearing? What are people in the community saying? First of all, did anyone think that this vote at a school committee in Portland last night would have this kind of national repercussion?
I don't think they did. Certainly, we've been a little bit taken by surprise by the number of phone calls that have come to us in the community. People are expressing disbelief over, not my kid, no way, over my dead body, that kind of sentiment. But on the other side, is there a need for those services? And that's, you know, what the folks who have been supporting passing this this measure have been saying, is people, if they don't seek it out at the health center, where are they going to seek it out? Is it going to lead to more teen pregnancy? Is that going to be a major issue? So both sides, pretty heated debate here in the city.
We understand that at the community health center, they're not only be offering contraceptives, but also counseling, and that some of the school committee members said that, in fact, they're hoping that as opposed to increasing sexual activity, they might actually, through the counseling, decrease the activity and the need for the contraceptives.
Yeah, health officials have said all along that you can't just walk in to the health clinic and they're just handing them out like it's lollipops. So what is supposed to happen is that they will go through a thorough physical examination, and there will also be counseling in addition in order to dissuade them from taking this step. However, if they choose to go forward, the health center will provide them with the contraception.
And again, parents who can afford their own private doctor can opt out.
The middle school has its own school nurse, which operates separately from the health center. But if a parent does choose to make use of it, yes, they can sign up and sign a parental consent form.
That's Jeff Wade, news director for WGAN Radio in Portland, Maine. We want to spend a few minutes today on a remarkable effort by a 27-year-old American who's keeping what's called the list, the names of 700 Iraqis who worked for the U.S. in Iraq and now need to come to the U.S. because their lives are in danger. Kirk Johnson knows some of those on his list. In 2005, he was one of the few Arabic speakers working for the U.S. Agency for International Development, first as an information officer in the Green Zone in Baghdad, then as the regional coordinator of reconstruction in the city of Lucha. He came home, began his list, it grew into a website, he's now lined up lawyers to help the refugees, but it's slow work. Of the 700 on his list, he's brought just 10 to the U.S. And Kirk Johnson joins us now on the line from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York with more. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Also with us, Kirk, is one of the Iraqis you've helped bring into the U.S. He's asked us to identify him only by his first name. Yagdan is here as well. Yagdan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Yagdan, I want to start with you. Kirk wrote about you in an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times last year. He described a terrible story, how you and your wife had to flee Iraq just after neighbors saw you leaving a Green Zone checkpoint, and then you found a severed dog's head with a threatening note at your doorstep. What did the note say?
Well, the note at that time said that we are going to cut the head and throw it in the garbage. So after I saw it, I was checking in the garden to see if there is any bomb or something. I found the dog head thrown in my garden. And then I found that it's a serious action. It's not something like just general threat.
That's terribly disturbing.
Yeah.
You and your wife, and by the way, you're both just 30, you flee. Did you think you were going to make it to America? I mean, was that your goal?
No, at that time it wasn't that my goal. I thought that my colleague in the agency, they will help me to find out a solution either by allocate me in another job in this in Iraq or send me to some other mission outside of Iraq. But unfortunately, nothing of that has happened.
By the way, can you tell us what were you doing? What kind of work were you doing?
Well, at that time, I was in charge of managing a contract with $13 million belonged to the U.S. government that's doing monitoring and evaluation for 64 contracts. And more than 14,000 activity, which is the general budget about $5.3 billion.
It's also worth mentioning, Yagdan was one of the highest-ranked Iraqis working for USAID in Iraq. He was also working to implement a huge education program, which was rebuilding schools and training teachers and things like that. So he was clearly valued by the mission.
Well, and Yagdan, you thought that that value would mean that someone would find you a place or another job, but they didn't. Where did you end up?
Well, in the beginning, I went to UAE waiting for a response.
United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, United Arab Emirates, waiting for a response from the agency. And at that time, I get contacted by my dear friend, Kirk. At that time, I was without hope, and I received back the information from the agency that I have to report to work or I will be fired.
And Kirk, you brought Yagdan to the United States, I understand, to live with your parents?
Yes, he's living in my childhood home now with my mom and dad, who are his official American sponsors and sort of ambassadors at large.
Yagdan, what is that like?
Well, they are very kind people, and they are very generous with me to open their house to a stranger that they just heard about him from their own son, and they show me really a very kind attitude of the American people, and they were supporting me all the time, trusted me by letting me using their cars and helping me in getting my driving license, getting my paperwork done. They provide us with full access to their house and full access to the facility in the house, and we are very grateful to that, because I consider myself lucky to have Kirk as a friend, and much more lucky to have his family as being now my family here in the U.S.
Well, Kirk Johnson, this is a wonderful for Yagdon's story, but we know that now you have a website through which Iraqis can contact you. You've got the list of, as it's called, of 700 names of Iraqis who work for the U.S. need to get out. You've lined up pro bono lawyers, starting to hire a few Iraqis to help you, but you can't put 700 Iraqis in your parents' house. And you've only been able to get 10 to the states. First of all, why is that? Because the Bush administration said that they would open up, ease passage for Iraqis who had worked for the U.S.
Well, I think we've entered into an era where a White House can say things and they're not required to actually act on them anymore. I mean, earlier this year, they made a promise to the Iraqi refugee population that they would try to admit 7,000 this year, and they fell woefully short of that, only admitting something like 1,600. I mean, I've created the most comprehensive list of Iraqis who need our help, and a couple have written to me while we've been talking. I get emails all the time now from Iraqis themselves, from diplomats, from soldiers and Marines and aid workers who know about the list and who are referring and desperately trying to get their Iraqis to safety before more are killed. And I've gotten in around 10 so far, but a much greater number have been murdered on the streets of Baghdad and Basra and Hilla that have worked for the State Department and USAID and for our military. What we need is an American president who's willing to recognize a moral imperative and act on it. This isn't something where we have to create some ridiculously complex process where Yagdan had to go through interview after interview after interview after interview answering the same types of questions. In our past, presidents just charter planes, they send C-130s over, and they get these people out of harm's way before they're killed.
Well, the White House has said that Iraqi refugees are a top priority and that they're trying to speed things up while also maintaining tough security procedures. But I'm wondering if you wonder that there might be some concern on the part of the White House that a large influx of refugees would be seen as some sort of loss of the war.
Well, I'm not interested in that. If the White House is operating under those kinds of political parameters in terms of appearances and in terms of what might look or be construed as one thing or another, I don't care. They're clinging to a realm of abstraction at that point. What I'm dealing with is a river of human suffering, of very real people who put their lives on the line because they believed in America and they tried to stand up for the things that we went into Iraq for, and now they're being gutted.
That's Kirk Johnson. He's 27. He's a former AID U.S. employee in Iraq who now is running the List Project to try to resettle Iraqis who worked with him and others, U.S. people, in Iraq. Yagdan is one of the first 10 Iraqis Kirk helped bring to the U.S. We're going to speak more to both of them after a quick break and ask Yagdan more about what it's like now that he's here. And don't forget, later in the program, director Wes Anderson on his new film, The Darjeeling Limited. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with Kirk Johnson, who worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development in Iraq and now runs the List Project, collecting names of Iraqis who were employed by the U.S. in Iraq, and he's trying to resettle them here. Also with us is Yagdan, one of the first 10 Iraqis Kirk Johnson has brought to the U.S. Yagdan is at Kirk's parents' house outside Chicago. And Yagdan, Kirk describes you as one of the most senior Iraqis employed by USAID in Iraq. You managed multi-million dollar contracts. We understand you have a refugee agency helping you to try to find work now. You've only been in this country for 4 weeks, but we hear you're experiencing something that other Iraqi refugees have told us about. Have you been able to find work?
No, it seems that all the experience that I have, it's no good in the U.S. And now I just get email from my organization who should work with me on the job issue. They advised me to cut my resume and make it one paper so I can get unskilled labor, because this is the best thing that they can offer. It really seems frustrated that with all this qualification and I cannot get a job. So far, I am applying for hundreds of companies, different type of companies, the big ones, the small ones, local and international, and no response from all of that. And so really, it's very difficult, and the life expenses there is too much, really. It's unreasonable that get some few tomatoes and potatoes, the basic needs for the grocery, and it will be like $70. Well, what's this? It's really too much.
Yeah, because of the cost of living is so much higher here. But we should point out, you do get some government aid, don't you?
Yeah, now I am receiving government aid as food stamps, but it's really to just cover the basic needs. It's only $200 for two persons, two adults that we have to live also.
So 8 months of about $200 a month for food stamps and some Medicare health treatment.
It's probably worth mentioning that the Iraqis on the list, and it's very similar to Yagdan, they were upper middle class, so to speak, and they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're civil engineers, and they're experts, and so it's not to suggest that everything needs to be handed to them when they get here, but it's a little difficult for them once they arrive to sort of accept this sort of unskilled labor, even though I told Yagdan that I come from a family of historically of garbage men. it's a tough sell. So, I mean, we are working hard to try to find folks meaningful employment when they get here, but it's, you know, these people are all in a state of shock and after what they've been through. My major goal is getting them here, and I'm trying to make it clear to all of them that once they get here, they've got to do their part by rolling up their sleeves. And I've told them, you know, that you ride through any major metropolitan area, and the guy driving you in the taxi is probably a doctor himself. For my part, I'm trying to create a fund that would be used on sort of on a need basis, so that if people like Yagdan and others get here, and they need, you know, a $2,000 loan to buy a cheap car so that they can get to work, that kind of thing, that I can sort of assist in that. But I haven't been aggressively calling for the government to increase any aid to them once they get here. That's sort of down the road. I just want to get my list here, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about you, Kirk, because it's a fascinating story. You're 27 now, 24, 25 when you were working for USAID in Iraq. You were very dissatisfied with the way the war is being implemented. You take a short break in the Dominican Republic and end up, for whatever the reason, you know, you fell out a window off a balcony. You smashed your face and your skull. You have to have major surgery. And that forces you out of your work in Iraq. By the way, you know, we've heard about aid workers and other, you know, private workers having sort of a post-traumatic stress disorder.
That was after a whole year of being in Iraq, and I think that's when my stress sort of caught up with me. And the second night there, I had what people think was a fugue state, it's called. But
meaning what?
Basically, I think I thought that I was back in Fallujah. The first night I was there, I was sleepwalking. But the next night, I never woke up. I wasn't that fortunate, so I was apparently sitting on the windowsill. I was apparently arguing with the guard. This is all his account. And then shortly after he wandered off, this is all at 4:30 in the morning, I tumbled out of the window and fell about 17 feet and hit concrete, and I broke both of my wrists and my jaw and my nose, and I cracked my skull, and I had about 70 stitches in my face. So that's what cut my time short in Iraq. I didn't quit. Okay. I wanted desperately to go back.
You're just a couple of years away from that, and here you are with this list that you've drawn up of 700 Iraqis that you want to bring to the U.S. If you try to bring in everyone that worked for the U.S., that could be several hundred thousand people. Have you taken on too much?
Well, I think in terms of the numbers, I mean, first off, the list is 700 and rapidly growing. So I don't have a ceiling on it. I'm meeting with USAID's implementing partners and others to try to, I want to build the list as aggressively as possible so that even if they haven't become refugees yet, they're at least on the radar, and we know that we know where they are and how to contact them. But in terms of what I've taken on, I don't really perceive it in along those lines. This was never really a decision for me. it's the clearest moral imperative that the war has ever presented. And for somebody to, I mean, the idea of turning our backs on people like Yagdan and all the others on whom we completely relied on and we wouldn't have functioned over there, it just seems so crystal clear that it was never sort of sizing up the fight or deciding what my commitment level will be. It's just everything has been sort of snowballing as the list grows.
Mm. Kirk Johnson, a former U.S. Agency for International Development employee in Iraq. He now runs the List Project to resettle Iraqis who worked with the U.S. in Iraq to bring them here to the U.S. We also spoke with Yagdan, one of the first 10 Iraqis that Kirk has helped bring to the U.S. In fact, he's settled Yagdan and his wife in his parents' home. Kirk, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, it's my pleasure.
And Yagdan, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And for more information on the List Project, go to our website, here-now.org. Looking ahead tomorrow on Here and Now, Stephen King on what makes a good short story. And still ahead today, what happens if Turkey follows through on yesterday's vote, attacks Kurds in Iraq, and is met by U.S. troops? That's after the news, Here and Now. It's all quiet on the Turkey-Iraqi border a day after Turkey's parliament overwhelmingly gave the prime minister permission to send troops into northern Iraq to do battle with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. The extremist PKK group has been fighting for a separate state for the minority Kurdish population in southeast Turkey for more than 20 years, and Turkish leaders say they took the step of authorizing an attack because of PKK raids inside Turkey that have killed at least 30 Turkish soldiers and civilians this month alone. Joining us now is Bülent Alireza. He's a senior associate and director of Turkish studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Bülent, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's get right to one of the thorniest questions to come of yesterday's vote. As you well know, U.S. troops are advising Kurds in the north of Iraq, their allies. The U.S. and Turkey are our allies. What happens if Turkey acts on yesterday's vote, attacks Kurds in northern Iraq, but confronts U.S. troops in the process?
I think it's unlikely. I think given the fact that there aren't too many U.S. troops in the north, as they're otherwise engaged in the rest of Iraq, I think both sides will avoid that kind of confrontation. Similarly, Turkey will want to avoid confrontation with Iraqi Kurds. The goal of the resolution that was passed is specifically to confront the PKK beyond Turkey's borders, and hopefully if and when they do intervene, there will not be any kind of confrontation either with the U.S. or the Iraqi Kurds.
Well, let's remind ourselves of the recent history here. The PKK have waged war against Turkey since 1984. In the 90s, Iraqis, Kurdish leaders worked closely with Turkey to fight the PKK. Relations were good. The PKK, its efforts were calmed down. And then the PKK launched again after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Why can't Turkey once again work with the Iraqi Kurds to fight the PKK as they did in the past?
Well, that question really ought to be directed at the Iraqi Kurds. This problem is an unintended offshoot of the Iraq war. The Turks were very much aware of this danger and made that their feelings known to the Americans before the war started. And nonetheless, nothing was done about the resurgence of the PKK within northern Iraq, where the Iraqi Kurds gained a high degree of autonomy. And here we are.
Other analysts as well are saying that the Iraqi Kurds have been loath to sort of upset the fragile balance that they have in the country, one of the only peaceful areas in Iraq after post the U.S.-led invasion. But how much of yesterday's vote is political on the part of the Turkish prime minister to send a signal of strength to Turks at home, who are increasingly unhappy with the PKK attacks, but also a signal to the U.S. Congress, which, as you well know, is considering that resolution calling the killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks decades ago a genocide?
Well, it's a combination of the escalation of the PKK attacks on Turkey recently and the vote in the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The Turkish public got enraged. The prime minister was then obliged to do what he didn't want to do before, which is to pass this resolution. And although it's a signal to the U.S. and to the Iraqi central government and to the Iraqi Kurds. Nonetheless, it's a momentous step because the next time the PKK attacks, there'll be tremendous pressure on the prime minister to react, and he may find it difficult to resist.
Well, I was going to ask you, is it something that was maybe more symbolic, as we just said, that could be forced to become a reality if the PKK does launch another attack? Isn't the prime minister then forced to act on the resolution?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, there is that resolution on the books, and the next time that there is an attack by the PKK, the Prime Minister will be obliged to do what he has been unwilling to do until now, which is to send his troops across the border with all its diplomatic, economic, and other consequences.
As opposed to a ground attack, is there consideration of another kind of attack, let's say airstrikes?
Sure. The main PKK camp is based in the Kandil Mountains, which is where Turkey, Iraq, and Iran meet. It's pretty much inaccessible by land for Turkish troops. So airstrikes are entirely possible. There's been speculation in the Turkish press about helicopter-borne commander troops, snatch and grab, if you like. The most unlikely scenario is for thousands of Turkish troops just across the border en masse.
In fact, the Prime Minister of Iraq called his counterpart in Turkey yesterday, probably with concern that might happen, saying that the Iraqi government would handle the PKK situation. But as others have said, the Iraqi government and the U.S. government have their hands full with other insurgencies in Iraq. Do you think it's realistic, if this was sort of a shout-out from Turkey to both the U.S. and Iraq to handle the problem of the PKK, is it realistic that they can?
No. Certainly not for the Iraqi central government. The Iraqi central government depends on the Kurds in order to survive. Mr. Maliki has very little authority in the north of Iraq, and I have absolutely no doubt that the galvanization of the Iraqi central government, which also involved the dispatch of the vice president to Ankara, was a product of U.S. pressure on the Iraqis to try and get over this particular crisis.
But you say that it really doesn't have any muscle behind it.
Oh, absolutely. The only ones who have the muscle are the American troops, who have been unwilling or unable to intervene in the north, and the Iraqi Kurds, who, for their own best-known reasons, have allowed this situation to fester.
So given all of this, and given that this is the reality on the ground, has Turkey set up a situation in which there really is no solution? If the U.S. has its hands full and Iraqi government can't do it, what worth was there of sending a signal to both parties if there's nothing really anyone can do?
Well, it's not the Turks who've set this up. It's the PKK with its attacks. It's the Iraqi Kurds for their unwillingness to move against them, and the U.S. government for failing to take note and to act on all the requests that the Turks have made over the past 2 years.
Yeah. Well, early next month, Turkey's hosting a summit of Iraq's neighbors. Prime Minister Erdogan is coming to the White House. And Turkey really very much wants to join the European Union. Is this resolution, and would be acting on this resolution, be a setback to all of that?
It might, but you know what? Turkey has to protect its national security interests, and the people are getting killed in the southeast of the country, and the threat is coming from northern Iraq. Turkey will take all the consequences into account. Besides, the European Union process was not going too well. There have been problems in the U.S.-Turkish relationship anyway. So unless somebody moves and deals with this issue in some other way, I think the Turks will be bound to intervene.
Bülent Alariza is Director of Turkish Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bülent, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And this note, Kurds in Iraq responded today to yesterday's vote in Turkey, waving the sunshine flag of Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region. More than 5,000 Kurds packed the streets of Dahuk in northern Iraq and called on the UN to stop any Turkish military activity inside Iraq. One of the protesters told Associated Press that Turkey was trying to disrupt the relative stability and economic success of Kurdish Iraq in order to prevent Kurdish separatists inside Turkey who want that same autonomy. The protesters said, Turkey's not chasing Kurdish rebels back across the border, as Turkey claims. Turkey is trying to degrade the dignity of Kurdistan's government. Thousands of school children also marched in Erbil, another Kurdish city in Iraq. They waved banners that read, understanding each other is better than killing each other. And Iraq's deputy prime minister, a Kurd, urged Turkey not to resort to military offense, saying no one would escape the consequences. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, who is going to win tonight's match between the Red Sox and the Cleveland Indians? A clue will be if I'm out sick, my poor Red Sox. And still to come today, director Wes Anderson, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, we haven't heard from you in a while, so let's take a few minutes to do that. Joshua Hughes of Portland, Oregon, wrote after our conversation with journalist Naomi Klein. She says that private security companies like Blackwater USA are part of an agenda to turn the role of government over to private concerns. Joshua doesn't see that as a bad thing. He writes, Klein's own example of private firms responding after Hurricane Katrina before federal agencies shows that private firms are much more effective than our bloated government. But Tom Plankon of Brockton, Massachusetts, shares Klein's concerns about citizens having to line up their own security or rescue services. He says, your discussion with Naomi Klein was one of the most riveting I've heard in a long time. I was listening on the way to lunch, and it made me lose my appetite. I've always understood that the free market works when consumers make rational choices. Well, there must be a new breed of consumer out there who can rationally make choices when they're in the attic with 10 feet of water below them or bombs going off in parked cars. Well, we also spoke recently with Diana Geddes of The Economist about what she calls the dangerous use of technology to eavesdrop on both Americans and the British. Geddes said, it's more important to preserve civil liberties than to save lives that might be lost in a terrorist attack. Well, at least two of you invoked Ben Franklin in your responses. Alex from Boston agreed with Diana. He writes, this trend must stop. As Ben Franklin said, they that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. But Patrick Daly of Philadelphia strongly disagreed. Give us a break, he writes. Geddes even admitted that Brits think the surveillance programs are a good idea. Thank goodness you weren't around when Ben Franklin set up the Postal Service. You'd have been concerned that the government was reading our mail, too. Well, we also heard from Jeff Field of Loudoun, New Hampshire. After our story on the Rod Serling Conference at Ithaca College, where the late creator of The Twilight Zone gave writing seminars to several lucky Ithaca students, including me, Jeff had his own favorite episode.
Once again, you hit one out of the park. I'm 52 years old, and I can remember the monster on the wing at 20,000 feet.
There's a man out there, or a gremlin, or...
There was some good stuff back in those days, and certainly Star Trek emulated the moral that went behind the real story.
Well, Jeff, not only did Star Trek, like The Twilight Zone, have a moral behind the story, but they both shared actor William Shatner, who played that man in that Twilight Zone episode who saw a gremlin on the wing. Well, we also had a story recently from former Here and Now intern Daniel Estrin from Jerusalem on the etrog, the lemon-like fruit used and then discarded by Jews during the harvest celebration of Sukkot. Joan Vick of Nashua, New Hampshire wrote, we've been recycling that fruit for years as etrog jam. The belief about etrog jam is if you feed it to a pregnant woman, she will have easy labor and fragrant children. I have several testimonials to that effect. And after we spoke with Wendell Jameson, author of Father Knows Less, his attempt to answer all his young son's questions, Anthony DeFeo wrote us. He says, my 4-year-old son Corwin and I were at a Labor Day cookout at a friend's house. My son asked, Dad, is this a story? Puzzled, I asked, is what a story? Looking around at the very nice yard with horses grazing in the background, he replied, this, all of this. Are we inside of a story? I tell him, yes, this is kind of a story. Corwin quickly asks, Dad, who will read the story of us? Well, we just did, Corwin. And finally, we heard from Olivia Graham in Oxfordshire, England, who came across one of our stories from 2003 on the internet about the now-closed Claremont Riding Academy in New York City. Olivia asked, did the horses go to good homes? Well, we called the academy and they said yes. Olivia also asked what song we played during the piece. It's Nina Gordon's Horses in the City. If you'd also like to hear the story, go to here-now.org, click on Archives, and go to June 3rd, 2003. And while at the website, send us your thoughts on anything on the program, here-now.org, or call, and you can leave a message at 617-358-0397 with your name and town, please. Okay, after a quick break, director Wes Anderson on his new film, The Darjeeling Limited, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Writer and director Wes Anderson's new film, The Darjeeling Limited, revives the theme of shattered families Anderson explored so well in Rushmore and The Royal Tenenbaums, and adds a gorgeous buddy movie travelogue as well. Set on a luxury train in India, The Darjeeling Limited reunites actors Owen Wilson and Jason Schwartzman and adds Adrian Brody as Francis, Jack, and Peter Whitman, three brothers who haven't seen each other in the years since their father's funeral. Francis, bruised and bandaged after an accident that might not have been an accident, invites his brothers to join him on a spiritual journey.
A, I want us to become brothers again like we used to be, and for us to find ourselves and bond with each other. Can we agree to that?
Okay. Yeah.
B, I want us to make this trip a spiritual journey where each of us seek the unknown and we learn about it. Can we agree to that?
Sure. I guess so.
C, I want us to be completely open and say yes to everything, even if it's shocking and painful. Can we agree to that?
Along the way, we see Anderson's trademark slow-motion sequences, hear vintage pop tunes, and meet emotional cripples. And Wes Anderson joins us in the studio now with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I have to say right off the top, some of your reviews were mixed this time around.
They always are.
Well, there was the sense that, you know, your cult would follow you, even if maybe the story didn't hold up to the pictures. Now, we are not in your cult. I am no critic. I loved this movie. And I love the story. Maybe it's saying something about me that the idea of, you know, siblings ping-ponging around after a parent dies seemed, you know, who hasn't been there. Where did the story come from?
I grew up one of three brothers, and for a long time I'd been wanting to make a movie about brothers. And then I had the idea that I would like to work with Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola, two of my close friends, writing together.
And Roman, of course, the son of Francis Ford.
Yes, and in the end, the three of us went to India to write. I'd been sort of fascinated with that country for many years, long before I ever went there.
And we should say there's more connective tissue because Roman and Jason are cousins.
Exactly. We set out to write a very personal story, more than I ever have before. That was really our credo. Hopefully it's something people can relate to for that reason.
So you were brothers in arms in making the film. Let's listen to the fictional Whitman brothers you created. They're in India on this so-called spiritual journey, which is also a search for their mother, who's just sort of dropped out after their father dies. In this scene, the train has stopped in the desert. Let's listen.
Brendan, what's going on?
I don't know. I guess the train's lost.
What'd he say?
He says the train's lost.
How can a train be lost? It's on rails.
Apparently we took a wrong turn at some point last night.
That's crazy.
How far off course are we?
Nobody knows. We haven't located us yet.
What'd you just say?
What?
What you just said. Say it again.
We haven't located us yet.
Ah! Is that symbolic? We haven't located us yet.
These are lost boys.
Right, that's true. Owen's character's goal, he's made laminated itineraries with a plan for them to find themselves and bond with each other. The first half of the movie is about the ways that they don't do that.
Right. Well, and you know, every family, or most families, especially dysfunctional families, have one of those. Someone who's going to make it all right.
Yes.
Who was it in yours?
In mine, I hate to portray myself as any type of control freak.
What, a director? No.
But, you know, when Jason and Roman and I went to work on the script in India, we would act out the script. Jason played his character, Jack.
The younger brother.
The youngest brother. Roman played the middle brother, Peter, that Adrian Brody plays, and I played Owen's character.
There you go.
Francis. Yeah.
So you are perhaps the one who, you know, wants to make it right.
Yeah, sometimes I keep the passports.
Who's Brendan?
My new assistant. He's going to place an updated schedule under our doors every morning of all the spiritual places and temples that we need to see, and expedite hotels and transportation and everything.
How's he going to do that?
Got him bring a printer and a laminating machine.
Sounds good, sure.
Yeah, it sounds good.
You have any questions?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
What happened to your face?
It's hilarious at times. I mean, the three brothers are just, from the instant they see each other, they each trigger reactions. They immediately start self-medicating. I mean, they're drinking whatever has the slightest bit of alcohol,
cold medicine or whatever,
smoking. They're like 10-year-olds. But then it's also incredibly poignant. They end up, you know, walking. Suddenly the film makes a sharp turn, and they're confronted with three children drowning.
Right. Something happens to them that's not on the itinerary. I think the whole idea of the movie was to take them on this train journey, tell this family story that's more of a comedy, and then in the middle of the movie, it becomes something different. And really, there's a certain point in the movie where everybody just stops talking.
They had wanted to go on a spiritual journey. Is that it?
Well, the idea of a spiritual journey is probably kind of a crazy thing. When we went to India and made this movie, we learned a great deal about things that I certainly knew nothing about. It was very emotional for me, and I also feel like I walked away really with a whole different set of ideas.
What is it that you learned? Just give us a sample of something.
I think what happens is, first of all, India is a place where I've never felt more foreign. In a country that I visited than an American, for instance, does in India. People stare at you all the time, particularly in rural India or in places where it's not used to people that look like us. But it's also a place where I've never felt more welcome. It's a place that's filled with religion, and there are so many different cultures, so many different languages, and so many people. And some people visit and they are overwhelmed, and some people visit and they get hooked. And that's what happened to me. I just absolutely fell in love with it, and it's a place I want to go back and visit again and again and visit other parts of India.
Well, besides, as one reviewer pointed out, if you had these brothers, you know, get on a train in America, they would look like commuters. I mean, there's just not that passion of that world buzzing around them that you would have once you put them in India.
Absolutely, and that's why we wanted to shoot it on a real train. And every day we went to film the movie, we set out on an adventure and didn't quite know exactly where we would end up.
One very last thing. We of course, have to ask you about Owen Wilson, who's at the center of this film. He plays the older brother whose head is swaddled from an accident that he's had. We find out later in the film that maybe, you know, he drove his motorcycle into a hill. He, of course, attempted suicide just before the film went on the festival circuit. It was very, very painful to see him as one of the brothers in character saying, "I had this accident, and you know, when I woke up in the hospital, the first thing I wanted to see was you guys," when in real life we know he has brothers. And also in the Royal Tenenbaums, he talks in the Royal Tenenbaums about having drug issues. So how eerie, weird has this been for you?
Well, I think drug issues is not really... If people have a perception that this stuff with Owen has to do with drugs, it's not. It has to do with depression, but that's not something I want to talk about. You know, he's one of my best friends in the world. The movie's written by me and Jason and Roman, so it's really from our experience and our point of view. And Owen's just a great actor who's helping us bring it to life. But, you know, those things are not connected. And that's, you know, that scene in the Royal Tenenbaums, that just comes from me. But I kind of think, you know, movies, they take on a life of their own, and life intersects with them. And in the same way, if somebody has brothers and sisters and they go see the movie, or if they've been to India and they see the movie, they bring all these other things in. So it's just, you know, they all mix together.
Well, you know, we're awfully glad that he is still here with us.
He's doing very well.
Yeah, that's good. Is there a possibility that your next film will have nothing to do with dysfunctional family relations, that it'll... I don't know, I can't even think.
I always try not to. This one, I was like, no parents. That was our opening thing, no
one
parents.
One is dead, one's disappeared, and yet...
They're all through the whole movie. But really, that was like part of our plan, no parents, just brothers. But it didn't work out that way. We needed them.
Wes, thank you.
Thank you.
Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited is open in select cities this weekend, nationwide, October 26th. For more on the film and for a link to his free 13-minute prequel, Hotel Chevalier, go to our website, here-now.org.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.